we hear from Moles Jan Hocken and Clayton Morgridge for a discussion of Clayton's new book, Demystifying Demons, Rethinking Who and What We Are. Jan and Clayton?
Well, Clayton, in addition to years of volunteering here at KBOO, primarily on the Old Mole Show, you bring to this book project many years of experience as a philosophy professor at Lewis and Clark. And having thought deeply about how to apply philosophy to problems in human living, the book is titled Demystifying Demons and works at the borders of philosophy and psychology, which interested me a great deal, how you bring psychology into a book that's kind of structured for kind of formally like a philosopher, but takes up much more material than you would find in a normal philosophy textbook. And I think it brings somewhat of a tone of ambivalence toward your own profession and addressing what's missing in philosophical arguments. And so we'll like to talk with you about that today. But you also make clear in the introduction that this is not a guide to living or self-help manual, even though you're clearly interested or have in mind a kind of practice as a philosopher that does attend to problems in human suffering. Mm-hmm. So tell us about what demons you're trying to demystify here, because you're talking about things that are maybe difficult to bear in mind in human consciousness, but also maybe to bear in mind in philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I guess I first want to make clear that the book is certainly by a philosopher, and it has a sort of a philosophical structure behind it. It's not written for philosophers, and it doesn't try to engage people's intellectual or conceptual puzzles in the way that philosophy often does. But as you said, the problems of real people's lives. And it sort of began with my own puzzlement about why I couldn't understand or control my own mind in ways that it seemed like I was expected to be able to do. That what I was supposed to be like as a student, for example, in school was to be hardworking and take my classes very seriously. And I wanted to do that, but yet I found a lot of resistance in myself to doing that. And I couldn't quite understand, I couldn't understand at all, where this resistance came from or why I resented so much that I resented about that those demands. And also just a lot of anxiety that I couldn't quite locate or understand what the reason for it was.
And indeed, your book seems to be a gift to your former self,
that's right.
Young Clayton, like many young people struggling to find their way in the world and to develop a stable, maybe conscience, a set of values. Eric Erickson talked about that transition to adulthood and making commitments and that there's something important and vital about what Freud called the superego or a sense of conscience. Mm-hmm. But you're saying it has this other side to it.
Yeah, a very judgmental side. And so I went on then, as you mentioned, to study philosophy as an adult or young adult. And because I was interested in these big questions about human nature and how society is put together and why we're supposed to do the things that we're supposed to do. But philosophy generally assumed that whatever was in the mind was there to be perceived, was conscious, and which didn't seem to be the case. And it focuses on our thoughts insofar as they can be controlled by reason. And it seemed to me that an awful lot of our thought is not controlled by reason and don't arise from rational sources. So I then turned to psychoanalysis, and that seemed right because it does focus on the unconscious, on things that are going on in us that we don't know we don't know that they're there, but they have a huge impact on us and a lot of control over us. But yet, at the same time, in reading people like Freud, I could never quite identify with that theoretical structure. I didn't quite see myself in the struggles between id, superego, and ego, and so forth, because I don't know, it just seemed too theoretical or abstract or something. So I kind of was searching for a way to explain to myself and to other people like my students the unconscious side of ourselves. And by beginning with ordinary experience that everybody shares, and that's something I always tried to do when teaching difficult topics in philosophy, is to bring it down to things that the students already experienced. And so So that's one side of it, was sort of the my personal experience and the question of the puzzlement about the unconscious. But then another side of this, which was I was disturbed by the in the way society works, by the dominant assumption that I think is an important part of our ideology, or of, you know, capitalist ideology, if you want, that each of us is individually responsible for our attitudes and our beliefs and the actions that result from them.
Our whole criminal justice system is based
exactly,
on that premise.
Exactly. And so this makes the assumption, again, that we know why we think and feel as we do, and that we can control what we think and feel. And this is part of the ideology of domination, because it blinds us to the way in which our minds and or our souls, as I like to say, are shaped and determined by the economic order we live in, or even more strongly, that our souls are inseparable from our relationships with the world at large, with the structures of the world, and with and with other people. So I wanted to develop an understanding of the soul as a deeply social thing that lives and breathes in relationships with others.
So when you use the term soul or demons, you're using them in secular traditions to refer to something deeply held.
That's right, yeah.
That has some sustaining presence. Mm-hmm. And it's always difficult to find language for that.
That's
even
right.
Even consciousness, you know, neuroscience isn't even close to unpacking how we understand the phenomenology of consciousness. But you're trying to capture something at that level of deeply held experience.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm. Yeah.
the way in which this, you're also addressing some of the limits that come with that, because there are romantic traditions of thinking about soul, or even angels and demons that speak to kind of the creative potential of human beings. But you kind of focus, you do address that, particularly as you work through what you call the negative emotions. Can you say something about what these more disturbing emotions that conflict with a kind of ideal self encompass?
Right. Well, the demons that I name and particularly try to analyze and trace back to their origins in our early childhood are rage, guilt, self-loathing, anxiety, and a deep sense of insecurity, or what R.D. Lang calls ontological insecurity. And the kind of explanation that I try to offer for these is that in early childhood, it's inevitable that there are times when we are frustrated as infants.
Or the environment will fail us in some way, or our caregivers.
Exactly. And I really like Donald Winnicott's phrase, tremendous things happen in the little world of the baby. Because I think we don't, as adults, we don't have any appreciation for what's going on in the experience of an infant who is asked to wait to be picked up or to be fed for a long time. I mean, many of us were raised at a time when there was the idea that you shouldn't be fed until 4 hours had passed, no matter how loud you screamed. And so there's a degree of rage, I mean, a powerful amount of rage that children feel, and it's directed in a way at their parents, whom they love and depend upon, but then that occasions, guilt for feeling so angry and even destructive at the way things are, at the world on which you depend.
Freud once said, one of my favorite lines is, we all want to remain His Majesty the baby,
yeah.
Maybe Her Majesty the baby, and that we never relinquish childhood as fully as we believe in humans enter adult life. And you really follow that as well, that line of thought, and how disturbing that is to discover how many of the wanting to be the center of someone else's world and feeling slighted, or the anxiety about being loved, or mm-hmm. and maybe envy is part of this as well, how these feelings that are so associated with childhood are not always incorporated easily into adulthood, and particularly maybe what you're talking about, a kind of Western ideal that is laden with kind of patriarchal masculine fantasies as well.
That's
about maturity.
Right, I mean, I think that we grew up, I mean, even as I was saying, like as a sixth grade student or a fourth grade student, feeling that I should be in control of myself and that I should be reasonable, but yet feeling all of these contradictory impulses. And so it was like I was supposed to be an adult already, but yet there was something that was infantile, but that was extremely disturbing. And I think that happens for many of us, possibly for all of us, that we're disturbed in our attempt to present ourselves as reasonable, responsible adults, while feeling sort of this desire to, you know, kick and scream and complain about the world.
So how did you bring some of these ideas into left politics? Because I think some of these are familiar to people who read, who follow lines of psychological thought that deal with the unconscious. But you also take some of this into what it means to try to change the world, to do a better job in the world, which also requires certain ideals and mm-hmm. that we don't live up to in social movements, right. And in some ways a superego that demands something of us.
Yeah. There's another side of infantile life, which is the desire for love, to love and to be loved, and to be a part of an affectionate community. And it begins with our relationship with our mothers, but then it grows and expands.
And people bring that into social movements.
And I think that one thing that we can do that expresses that love is to understand that we are all victims or survivors of these of difficult childhoods, mm-hmm. and nobody is perfect, nobody is pure, and that what we need to do is to develop a way of living both in our movements, but then also aiming towards a better world that is organized around love without the expectation that everybody is going to be perfect all the time.
And that can be a dynamic in social movements, particularly if there is, you talk about the big bad other, where those unacceptable parts of oneself are then projected outward, or you begin to rely on the opposition in order to feel good about yourself and your group, we're good, they're bad. Can you say a bit about that? And we have, of course, plenty of material for that these days. We've got a really big bad other going on with this administration. But there's some cautionary you have toward that dynamic.
Right. I mean, I think that all sides of the political spectrum tend to identify their group as the good and the other groups as bad, and that somehow the world as it must be someday has to be when we're the good people in charge and the others are somehow vanquished or subdued. But I think, again, just that's a trashing everybody who voted for Trump, for example, is a bad idea. Yeah. That we need to try to understand where they're coming from and try to develop a politics that will be inclusive.
And more empathic and maybe understanding of how difficult it is, this project of a social transformation, given what people bring to it. Well, in closing, I just want to make sure people know where our listeners know where to get the book. It's a fabulous book by, I call, sage and savvy philosopher.
Thank you, Jen.
The kind of philosophy that we all wanted to take in college but didn't get in those classes that were impossibly abstract. It's called Demystifying Demons, Rethinking Who and What We Are. And you can get it by ordering it on Amazon by Clayton Morgridge. Thanks so much for being here today and talking about your work, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, Jan. I really enjoyed this.
My mind's got a mind of its own. Takes me out of walking when I'd rather stay at home. Takes me out to parties when I'd rather be alone. Lord, my mind's got a mind of its own.